Hello everyone, and welcome to the third episode of Paleo Party Season 2, sponsored by the Paleontological Society. As always, I'm joined by the wonderful Emma and Chris, and everyone here on the chat in Twitch, and we have a very special guest this evening. He's a paleo artist, a Twitter icon with a penchant for invertebrates, and he's possibly a secret crab overlord. It's Franz Anthony, everyone!
Woohoo! Thank you for having me and my crabs. My crab army.
So we're asking all of our guests to attempt to explain what they do using the Opgor 5 text editor, which only allows you to use the 1,000 most commonly used words in the English language. This is especially tricky given that paleontology nor fossil appear amongst these words. So Franz, do you want to take it away?
Right. This is going to be a little bit trickier because what I do is a little bit less straightforward. So let's try if this makes any sense at all. So I tell people that I draw animals to make money, but actually I spend too much time looking at little weird animals under leaves and reading a lot of words, mostly reading a lot of words on my computer, so I can guess what their very old, very dead friends might have looked like when they were not dead.
That is an adorable Upgoer 5.
That was so cute.
Yeah. That is super interesting, actually, because it's something I'd not really thought about. But I guess as your job as paleo artist and everything like that, it's you have to do a lot of background work to find out about these things.
Yeah, and it's not really a part of my online brand, but I actually do a lot of things with living animals as well over here. It's just that they're not always in English, so I don't always post them online. Yeah, but I guess my work is kind of interconnected in one way or another, if that makes sense.
Certainly does. But yeah, obviously we are live here today. So if anyone has any questions for Franz about paleo art or weird animals, or if you want a crab fact, because I happen to know that there's an extensive array of crab facts waiting for you, send us in a message either on Twitter or in the Twitch chat, and we will happily read out your questions.
I want to actually start completely left field, and you work a lot on fossils and particularly invertebrates, but I want to know what your favorite living vertebrate is.
Oh, this is
Did
hard.
Did I just break you?
No. I do actually, I don't talk about vertebrates much, but it's mostly only because I feel like they have been given enough attention, but there are a lot of vertebrates that I like. One of the main one that keeps popping up in my head every now and then is the chicken, because well, my profile picture everywhere has been a chicken for maybe the past 10 years or so, and this is kind of
I was wondering where that was coming from.
So my grandpa has a history with chicken. He had a chicken farm, but that's kind of beside the point. But the idea is that I feel like chicken is one of the animals that people take for granted. But actually, if you look at their history and how their relationship has been going on with humans for like the past few centuries, you can start noticing a lot of interesting things. For example, you know that people breed a lot of chickens for their fancy feathers, for their appearance. And over here we have bird shows where people breed the best looking animals. Well, it depends on what they're after. The best looking animals for basically some kind of pageant show. I'm not just like how maybe you Europeans do with dogs and cats and all that, but a lot of people here are into birds, and so bird pageant show is a thing. Yeah, so some chickens are bred for the feathers, and some are for their voice. And there's a chicken breed that is specifically bred because they have a sound like the sound of a person laughing.
No way!
How weird!
Yeah. There's a video of it on YouTube, actually, but I'll just have to pull it up for you guys later.
If anybody listening to this wants to hear a chicken sounding like a person laughing, you know where to go.
I feel very similarly about the pigeon.
Yes.
Because pigeons, I think that they're very beautiful. Like, they have these, like, you know, oily colored feathers. You know, when they haven't been mauled by other pigeons and other birds, they are very good looking animals, and yet they get such stick because I think a lot of people think of them as pests, and it makes me super sad because I love pigeons. I think they're great.
Also, we're responsible for the pigeons being everywhere. It's like, it's a classic human thing that we spent years and years breeding them and using them for all these different things. Then we just kind of forgot about them. And now we're like, oh, they're so annoying.
Well, eating them. Like, yeah. That's the thing, is that it's, and I was saying this in a weird conversation with a friend a while back about how, you know, like, people brought, like, the Romans famously brought them to a lot of countries, and especially to the UK, so that they could eat them. And then obviously they left and the pigeons stayed. And we just don't, and not many people eat, like, pigeon pie used to be very common, didn't it? But no one eats them anymore. But I was saying that the other day that maybe we should eat seagulls, because there are a lot of seagulls here and they're pests, and maybe we could eat seagulls, but no one does.
I found out that some seagulls, some of the common ones, are on the protected species list, or listed as, is it threatened? Or it's like unbelievable. Like, Franz, to give you, I live in Brighton by the sea, and it is terrifying to go outside in tourist season, because you will get mobbed by seagulls if you have any scrap of food on you. They will hunt you down. It is like Jurassic Park. It is wild. They're everywhere and everyone thinks of them as a pest, but apparently they're not, because my friends currently have a seagull and its chicks on their roof. And so they were like, oh, what can we do about this? Oh, like, because it's keeping them up all night. And they were like, oh, is there anything we can do? And they looked it up, and no, because they're listed as protected species, so you cannot do anything about it. And one fell off the roof the other day, and then they saved it and put it back in their nest. There's my seagull
pets. A heartwarming paleo party seagull special.
I guess we better move on to fossils now. People are like,
well, I like that. I like the chicken. I think that's a really good answer. And the other thing as well is that we can tie it a little bit back to paleontology, because there's a big debate, isn't there, at the moment, about the Anthropocene, which is this idea that human beings have changed the planet enough that we're in a new geological time period. And some people are suggesting that we mark the beginning of the Anthropocene. Well, basically, there's a big debate about when we mark the beginning of the Anthropocene. But one thing that I noticed that was really interesting was that you can mark the beginning of the Anthropocene when farming enters sort of the rock record, because agriculture obviously develops somewhere in, like, sort of the Mesopotamian basin and then expands outwards. But one thing that's really interesting now is that you can look at chickens and you can plot, like, their sort of bone structure, and then how suddenly the invention of growth hormones changes the bone structure. So you now get these mega chickens that have, like, really big legs, specifically for KFC and other fast food restaurants. There are other fast food restaurants available. So, and how their legs get really big because those are the parts of the animal that we want to eat. So we, like, genetically modify them, kind of. And that's pretty crazy that you can look at that in the fossil record. Yeesh.
I say, there's more, like, chickens are, like, one of the most abundant vertebrates on Earth, right? Like, as a single species.
Whoa.
So, yeah, their bones will be everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
Yeah.
That's wild. That is wild.
Yeah. It would be possible to tell what the chickens would have looked like based on the bones only, though.
I don't think you would be able to know much about their soft tissues, or their feathers or anything like that, but you definitely get an idea if the bones are, like, much shorter and stockier in the legs, yeah, because they want more meat. Like, you would definitely be able to see that. You'd be able to work that out, I guess.
Even going, like, further beyond that, if we didn't have chickens nowadays, how would they be reconstructed? Like, they wouldn't have any of those
the combs, yeah.
Whatever this is, I'm waving, like,
over. Yeah, I was going to say you're waving. As a child, I would refer to as a gobble bit. But now I think I know that the technical word is a comb. But yeah, Emma was doing a good mime of, like, their sort of hand up in the air flopping around situation.
I don't think artists would have been able to like predict that that's there.
Yeah.
I guess we don't really add them. Or maybe, Franz, you're the perfect person to ask. Wow. Do you see artists adding these and frills and extra bits just willy-nilly, or do they actually try to think about where they might be, or can you tell us more about this?
I think there's been a growing movement in belly art where people are starting to think about things that are not merely functional. For example, back then, people would think about how big their muscles would be, how big, what kind of bite strength they would have. But lately, people are starting to think about maybe coloration and then display structures. For example, like birds, they might have like a pouch. I don't know what it's called. I'm not really in touch with the English side of bird people. So I don't know the terms.
Nor am I. Just, yeah. We'll call it a gobble bit. It's fine.
Yeah, but basically, belly art is heading there these days. People are starting to speculate things that are not merely functional because, well, the functional parts have been talked about so many years ago, so people are starting to have a little bit more fun these days.
Oh, that's a nice way of putting it.
Someone in the chat has already told us it's a wattle. Thank you. Thank you, chat. Thank you, Sherry D. I appreciate that.
I was actually going to ask Franz, kind of along a similar vein. One of the things I'm always really fascinated with paleo artists is, like, you're given a rock, effectively. You know, you've got a little square, especially someone like you who works with invertebrates and really, you know, is so keen to draw invertebrates.
The best fossils, that's why.
So you're given these rocks with like a little splodge on it. And I mean, how do you even begin to make that into not just like an accurate reconstruction of an animal, but a reconstruction of an animal that is, you know, alive? You have a real amazing way in your art of making these creatures look like they're, you know, they're breathing and living in front of you. So yeah, I just wondered, what's your process? Like, how do you talk to the paleontologist? How do you go from that initial thing, like, okay, I'm going to draw, this is the creature I'm going to draw. How do you go from there to the you know, signing your name at the end of putting it together?
Right. So basically, there are a lot of ways to begin, but I personally prefer fossils that I can discuss with someone, because some fossils are exactly as you say, this is just like a blotch on the rock and there's not much to say about it. And so people usually tend to be a little bit more selective about what they can draw and what they cannot. So when I, well, you know, my online brand is mostly crabs, and that's, I blame the crab people because they are the ones who answer all my questions more than anyone else.
Oh, I blame the crab people might be another t-shirt. We might have to make that into some more paleo party merch.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And the good thing about crabs that they're still alive today, so we can still draw a lot of comparisons between the extinct ones, the ones that just basically are just rocks, and the ones that we can still see in the seas today. So when I'm shown that picture of a lump of the rock, I would then start asking the paleontologist question, what kind of crab is this related to? Do we have a living relative or not? If not, what kind of crab is this animal most likely superficially resembling? So it's sometimes there's just like lost families of animals that don't have living members anymore. So we just have to guess based on maybe not their general appearance anymore, but maybe would they live in deep sea or in the shallows? I feel like this is the kind of questions that I personally cannot answer because I'm not a geologist, so I don't know if this sediment, the rock, is made of things that are usually found in the coast or in the deep sea or maybe in freshwater. I don't know anything like that, so I usually try to consult someone who knows better.
Yeah.
And I think knowing the environment is one of the things that direct the artwork a lot more, because when you know the environment, you know what kind of you can guess what kind of colors it would have looked like. Maybe for animals that live in deep sea, it's more likely to be white or red. But if it's in the shallows near coral reefs, it's probably going to be more colorful. And if it's on sand, it's probably going to be more like beige, cream, brownish, something like that. So there's a lot of things to consider.
Because I've had the privilege of working with you in the past on some fossil cephalopods, and I think it's really interesting that you say that you like working with people who answer your questions, because one of my biggest I think there's this perception that as paleontologists and as scientists, like, we know the answers to everything, and we don't. And there's a lot of, so I remember, like, you would send me messages on Twitter and be like, hey, so there's this really cool fossil and it looks really weird, like, what do you think? And I'd be like, I don't know. And then you'd be like, well, what about this? And I'd be like, I don't know. And you were always so kind with your time, because you were always like, okay, that's cool. And then you just draw this amazing thing and I'd be like, huh, that makes sense. So yeah, is that difficult as an artist, you know, having to fill in those blanks sometimes? Do you worry that you're going to get someone who on the internet is going, actually, I don't think that's correct? Is that something you worry about?
I do worry about it once in a while, I guess. But I feel like the internet's just basically just toxic in general. I just give up on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just how the internet works. So whatever.
Yeah.
But I do try to be very careful about everything I do. So I usually try to avoid controversial ideas whenever possible. Yeah.
So stick away from Spinosaurus.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally, yeah.
Stick away from dinosaurs, full stop, and you're grand. That's a pretty good philosophy though, in general. Just the internet is what it is, and it's gonna always be like that.
Yeah.
I think
you're one of the weirdest things that's ever happened to me in my career as a paleontologist was working with you on those cephalopods. And then you produce that amazing plate of all of the different fossil cephalopods, like a sort of evolutionary history. And it's beautiful. And then I was walking down a high street and I saw a woman wearing a dress made out of it. And I was like, what? That is crazy.
Oh, wow. Did you ask her anything about it?
I was a bit scared at the time because I didn't want to just go up to her and be like, hey, fossil octopus, let's talk. But... yeah, I should have. Maybe I should have been more brave and just been like, excuse me, would you like to talk about fossil octopuses?
You could have even been like totally fangirling as well. You could have been like, oh, I know the artist.
Yeah, I should have. Maybe I should have been like, man, the artist is my friend.
It's funny though, because I started that one because back then, maybe around 2015, 16, I was mostly just doing dinosaurs because I feel like dinosaurs were still kind of growing back then. And it's not like the paleo art scene is pretty much blooming as it is now, because there's a lot of young artists, basically teenagers, who are drawing really amazing things because they have so much information readily available for them. But back then, it was mostly just, there were probably a few established artists and like maybe a few dozens of growing ones, but not like hundreds like we have now. But then I started to feel like, I think dinosaurs is kind of, the community is kind of cramped. There's a lot of people doing dinosaurs already. So what if I started to branch to other things that I personally actually like better, which are invertebrates. So I started doing cephalopods as my first invertebrates because I thought, they're basically the superstars of invertebrates, don't you agree?
I think we said that in the last podcast. They're basically the dinosaurs of the invertebrate world.
Yeah, basically. And it's funny though that in the past year, somehow crabs have kind of achieved that kind of level, because the memes are everywhere. Nobody could like ever expect that.
If somebody is playing a drinking game for every time we mention the word crabs.
Oh, we should have said that at the beginning.
Oh, man.
We should have said, play along. But we're encouraging responsible drinking here at Paleo Party, obviously. Oh, yeah. The crabs. Yeah, they have. You have like kind of built that as your meme now. Do you ever wake up in the morning and go, oh, no, not more crabs?
Well, I'm a little bit I'm a little bit torn about it.
That was definitely a sort of that was a yes, but I don't want to upset my crabby fan base.
Yeah, I'm a little bit torn because I'm glad that this kind of animal that previously people just basically don't care about are starting to get recognition because they are actually interesting. But on the other hand, the crab meme that goes, this is the crab cycle. There's only one step and it is crab. I get that basically every few days on Twitter. It's just, I get it. It's funny because, but I've seen it maybe a few hundred times. So please don't send me that one ever again.
So I'm going to drop him in it here and he's going to hate me for it. But a friend of the show, Jim Jam, at the beginning of the chat asked, I know it's a tired meme. Oh no, he said, I know it's a bit of a tired meme at this point, but why does everything keep evolving into crab-shaped animals? And then I was like, maybe we'll come to that later. And then Jim Jams replied saying, I've just realized who Franz is from Twitter and I completely regret my first question. I'm so sorry. And now I've outed him. He's just in the chat going, no. Sorry, Jim Jam. So sorry.
I still like the crab memes, but please set me to fresh crab memes.
Yeah, only your finest.
We only want freshly caught crab memes here, please.
Yeah.
Oh dear, oh dear. So one thing that I would like to touch on is how did you get started in art and paleo art? Like, what's your... Because so far on the podcast, we've had quite a few early career researchers who have told us how they've got into paleontology, how they got into the science. We've had curators who told us how they got involved. I'd really like to know how you got involved and how you fell into the world of crabs, the dark, seedy underworld of crabs.
Oh, so if you ask me how I got into art, it's basically I've just been drawing ever since I was a child. So it's just like just one thing that I just do naturally. But then when I went to college, I actually did graphic design because illustration and drawing is not really a thing here. It's we don't really have a big art scene, like a big art in a way that is a little bit more pragmatic, that is more useful and not like fine art. It's not really a scene that exists here. So I got into graphic design. So my background is actually more into the communication side of visuals. So it's not more, it's less of my self-expression and more about how I communicate difficult ideas through visuals. But I did work for a graphic design company for about 3 years or so. But then again, I would always still draw on sites as my freelance gig. But then maybe about in 2015, 16, when Tumblr was still a big thing, I started posting my things there and people started finding my drawings of animals. Mostly back then it was mostly random animals and once in a while dinosaurs and all that. So I started connecting with people here and there. I started volunteering for Art Archives, which is a website where people post news about the latest paleo stuffs and all that. And it was also through Tumblr that I met Emily Gressley from DBS. Yeah, she was probably one of the most influential person in my art career these days because she was the one who connected me with PBS Eons on YouTube. And also she basically hired me to do the graphics for her show called Prehistoric Road Trip last year. It was such a big deal for me back then because I felt like I live in a place where paleontology is not a big thing. So it's not, we don't really have museums and fossils and all that. So for me to met with someone like Emily back then through Tumblr, it was just a magical thing. Because it felt like I could finally find my fellow weirdos on the internet. And that's just, I feel like sometimes the internet is a mistake, but sometimes the internet is just kind of a magical place on its own.
Oh, we're so, big fans of Emily here. So
yeah. And the chat is going wild. Like people are saying, you know, like, you know, I love the art on Prehistoric Road Trip, and no way that show was so good. So I think you really, yeah, that was, it was, and the stuff that you did as well, it's so like recognizably yours as well. It's brilliant artwork. Beautiful stuff.
It's funny, it's I didn't know you came from a graphic design background, but you can so kind of see that because you're so good at translating information in your paleo art, right? Like how these animals, I was saying about how these animals interact with the environment around them, what they're doing. They feel so alive, and you can really see that kind of information being transferred to the audience, which is so important in paleo art. So yeah, it's amazing.
I think there are a lot of different ways to approach art because, you know, there are a lot of people who are actually working paleontologists who are also artists, and they definitely know a lot more than I do about the anatomy of stuff and how muscles work and all that. I don't know any of that without asking the actual experts, but I'm personally more concerned about how people will perceive my artwork. What kind of information they're gonna get? Is this gonna cause misconception or not? So yeah, I'm more interested in on the people side of things, on the viewer side of things.
That definitely shines through your art, even just the way you lay stuff out when it's all in those posters that all of these animals are together. It's just, it's visually so appealing, and then you get sucked in, and you're gone.
Thank you.
Was it difficult to make that transition from being like doing graphic design and then creating art into creating animated pieces? Was that difficult for you?
Technically no, but I think the hardest part was more like on the networking side of stuff. It's the hardest part was finding enough jobs and gigs for me to sustain myself, because when I did graphic design, it was a 9-to-5 job, so it was really stable. But I would work on things on the side to build up my portfolio, to build my network. But later on, I think I only managed to do art full-time because I moved back with my mom a while ago for practical reasons. But not having to pay rent back then was a big saver, time saver for me, because I could spend more time doing things that I actually care about. And then it just snowballed from there, because when I started having more time to do things that I actually care about, I started finding my own weirdos, and they're basically the crappy people found me around then. And they just roped me into their community, and they started feeding me a lot more crap information than anyone could ever need.
Enablers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that. I love that you were like, oh yeah, I found my own weirdos. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure the weirdos found you, my friend.
Mutual relationship. Yeah, exactly. Symbiotic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like those little crabs that use the anemones for boxer crabs that use anemones as little like gloves. You're the boxer crab of the art world. There you go. How do you like that?
Yeah,
what
that's
a
fine.
Title.
Yeah, what a title. Oh dear.
Thomas mentioned a little while ago that your art is so uniquely yours. Like when you see a piece of art on the internet, I can kind of usually tell if it's yours or not. And I think that for me comes down to some of your color palettes and just the way that you use colors. Do you consciously do that, or is it just something that just grew and now you suddenly have a color palette that you use or a type of texture that you use?
Yeah, I do. As for the color, I think I gravitate something. It's a little bit hard to explain, but my main interest is actually not crabs, but it's more like colors in nature. And it's just crabs happen to be one of the more colorful animals out there. And so I really like to think about how animals would have looked like in life in terms of their color and what function the colors serve. And so I think you can see that my artwork tends to be a little bit more on the bright side, but also not like bright neon colorful side, because I kind of tone it down. So it's kind of colorful, but also muted in a way.
Yep.
It's a little bit hard to explain.
It's definitely, iconic in one way that I wouldn't even be able to explain it. So if you can, then I'm happy with that.
Yeah. But I feel like a lot of fossil invertebrates haven't been getting enough attention, because when you see them in museum dioramas or reconstructions online, back then, I mean, not now, people are starting to get there now. Back then, it was mostly everything was just brown and black. But when you look at crabs that live today in the oceans, they're really colorful. They can be bright red, yellow, and they can even produce some of the colors that are practically really hard to produce in the animal kingdom, which are blue, green, and purple. Basically, everything that involves mixing blue is really hard to produce in the animal kingdom. And crabs basically can come in any kind of colors.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
That is, yeah. It's so true, though. Like, I remember going to a museum a while ago, and they asked me to, like, talk about one of the exhibits, and they had all these, like, lovely little arthropods, like, scurrying around in the undergrowth, and they were all brown. I was like, you know, even if you go to the wild today and look, like, some of these will be bright orange and yellow and, you know, just, you know, we obviously we can't tell, but we can make best guesses kind of thing. Yeah. I always feel so sad when I see just brown invertebrates. So sad.
Yeah, it's funny because I also look at a lot of wild animals today, mostly bugs. And, well, to be honest, they're mostly brown and black. But also, some of the ones that really stand out, they're really magnificent. They can be, it just doesn't make any sense for an animal to be bright white or maybe bright red when everything else is trying to blend in. Most animals are trying to blend in with their surroundings, or they try to be brown or black. They don't want to be seen. If they're a prey, they don't want to be seen by their predators. And if they're a predator, they do not want to be seen before they pounce, of course, right? Mm-hmm. So everything basically don't want to be seen, but some invertebrates are basically just all over the place. You just don't know why. Why are you red? Why are you like polka dot? And why are you stripy?
Yeah.
It don't make any sense.
It's weird, isn't it? Because some animals, like you said, obviously camouflage with colors, and then some obviously have crypsis, which is this thing where they mimic the shapes of their of the environment. So like there's a thing like the leafy gecko, which has like of frills and things, and it blends in with the tree litter and things. But then some animals are like, nah, not going to camouflage. I'm just going to let everyone know that I'm really toxic and really poisonous. Yeah. And I'm going to create all these crazy colors so that something won't want to make, like, so I don't look appetizing. And then other animals have seen that and been like, hey, that's a pretty cool strategy. I'm not toxic, but I'm going to do that anyway. I think, like, yeah, it's wild. And then you have animals like butterflies, which are just like, I'm just going to make every color, whatever I can do. I'm going to go full ham.
Yeah.
Oh, we not, can't
no,
mention
not,
the ham.
No, not don't ancestral mention the ham.
Not bivalve ham. No, we're not. No.
Throwback.
Yeah. No hams here.
But bivalves, though, Katie told me something interesting a while ago when I was doing bivalves. Basically, some bivalves are colorful on the inside of their shell.
Oh.
For whatever reason. So basically, these animals are colorful on the side that nobody's ever going to see until they die.
It's like a private little party.
Yeah.
For themselves.
That's what I was just thinking. I was like, in fairness, if I had to sit in a room all the time, I'd want to paint the walls a nice color. So maybe they're in there just like, well, if I have to look at the inside of this shell, I'm gonna make it nice.
If I'm going to be here for a long time, might as well decorate. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, that's actually the way you phrased it, though, the way that nobody sees the inside color until they die. It's kind of poetic. Like,
yeah, it's kind of
a bit morbid.
Yeah,
So you've worked with Katie a little bit recently, right, Franz? You've doing some stuff on about bivalves.
Yeah, lately I've been trying to educate myself a little bit more about all the different animals that exist in the oceans. So I talked to Thomas a little bit about this a while ago. But basically, I really want to reconstruct how the oceans evolved throughout the ages. The more I read about it, the more I felt underqualified for this, because it felt like such a big topic, and it's just so hard to comprehend everything that is in the ocean. So I've been trying to work with different people every month to produce how to draw guides that can basically tell other paleo artists how to draw. The first one was crabs, and the second one was bivalves with Katie. So it was basically about what their appearance were like, so their body shape, and also their color, and also how their color maybe affect their lifestyle, maybe. So maybe the bifolds that are brown maybe might be doing this thing, and the bifolds that are white might be doing other things. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of topics that I've been exploring. But it's such a time-consuming thing to do, because I know quite a bit about arthropods because they're all around me. I live on dry land, so I know what bugs look like. So it wasn't hard for me to jump from bugs to crabs. But bivalves are just so weird. It took me a whole month to actually understand the basics of it. And Katie was so patient with me about it. They kept answering me so many of my questions throughout the month. It was a process that took a whole month.
What's next?
I'm taking a break this month because, as I said, it's taking too much of my time and I need to do other things. But in July, I'm going to do trilobites, which is one of the most requested group so far.
Unsurprising.
Yeah.
A good jump between trilobites and bivalves, though.
Yeah. I'm actually trying to, as I said, I know a lot more about arthropods than other marine animals. I've been trying to explore worms, but worms is such a big topic because it's not just one phylum, but it's a lot of different animal groups combined that we all happen to call worms because they are long.
They're basically like thin tubes of meat.
Basically just tube animals. Yeah. We just call everything worms. But actually, there are a lot of really interesting worms in the oceans these days, but I just don't feel like I understand them enough to start making guides about them. But I'm going to dig into worms eventually.
Hey, nice.
But for now, it's just going to be trilobites.
Nice.
Yeah, they're pretty close to bugs, in fairness.
Basically bugs.
Well, there's currently I live in Birmingham, and there's a site called Wren's Nest where you can find trilobites just on the road, which is in an area called Dudley. And they actually refer to the trilobites they find there as the Dudley bug. So there you go.
Yeah, that makes sense. I live in an area where everything is wet and humid, so we don't get many fossils around here.
Mm. Oh.
We do get some fossil bivalves, freshwater bivalves, and maybe some corals, maybe. But basically, they're really small and they're not very attractive, I would say, in terms of their appearance. Basically, just a lot of random little things.
Mm. Yeah. But with you and your art behind these kind of less charismatic animals, I'm using air quotes here, but the best PR ever.
Well, maybe I'm going to cover them eventually. I just don't know enough about them right now.
Like, story of our lives. I feel like sometimes the paleontological process of there's people who find the fossils, there's researchers who like trying to figure out what they do, and then there's artists that really bring them to life. And it feels like to me that should be a complete jigsaw piece, but actually none of us know what we're doing and we're all just guessing.
It's just so much to know.
That's everything though, isn't it? I mean, I don't think there's any profession where they're not just making it up as they go along.
Don't tell anyone, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Tell anyone. Yeah.
No.
We had a good question quite early on from BWit47 that said, do you have any favourite bad paleo art? And I think that's kind of unfair on you because I don't want you to have to name names and throw shade. But I mean, so I think there's an interesting thing that we can unpack a little bit here, which is that there's bad paleo art because it's aged, and then there's bad paleo art because it's bad.
Yeah.
When you're looking at paleo artists' work, maybe not present paleo artists, but when you're looking at like paleo artists in the past, do you ever look at something and just go like, what?
Yeah. For all of you over there, I think the Crystal Palace dinosaurs are really iconic. But I only found out about them when I was 25 or so. So for me, they're really a fascinating part of the history of ballet art that I never knew before, because it was such a thing that just never made it here. I feel like a lot of information about science and paleontology in general just never makes it to Southeast Asia. So it was such a fascinating idea for me to think about what kind of things they had in mind back then, because they obviously don't have as many bones as we have now. They don't understand the relationship between the thing that they had back then and the animals that we have today. It's just, they were basically just guessing a lot of things. Like the iguanodon of the Crystal Palace is just so different from the actual animal. And I feel like it's a really iconic statue that I always think about a lot.
Actually, I think I've thought about that really recently. There's a paleo artist that I absolutely adore. And their art is quite, the lines are quite straight and round. There's quite a lot of, like, I imagine it's much more of a graphic than an artistic reconstruction of like a mural kind of thing. But it actually has kind of come full circle in that iguanodon is so chonky, like really thick. Yeah. And then the art that's kind of come out nowadays is quite thick and chunky as well, and it kind of works like that. But yeah, they're really funny looking things nowadays when you really think about them.
Yeah, the Crystal Palace dinosaurs have like a really funny place in my heart as well, because I was quite into dinosaurs when I was very little, and then I like sort of kind of forgot about them until I was a bit older and got into paleontology when I was much older. But I had a book that was called, like, I think it was called like The Dawn of Life or The Dawn of the Dinosaurs, something like that. And it talked about like the evolution of dinosaur studies as opposed to about dinosaurs in general. And I must have skim read it or something, because for the longest time, I genuinely believed that, I didn't realize that the iguanodon was an iguanodon. I just thought it was just a weird old fossil. And I just thought that was it. And it wasn't until I was about 18 that I was like, oh. And then I realized what happened. And I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Something that you mentioned there a second ago that I really wanted to pick back up on was that some of these things don't reach Southeast Asia, the way the paleontology that we take for granted in the UK, the US and global North countries that really have held power and knowledge for so long. And do you think that affects your art? Are you able to view it from a slightly less historical lens and jump in wherever you want? Or do you think it really hinders art and the development of art in other places that aren't knowledge centers?
Yeah, this is such a big topic, but I feel like...
Sorry for just throwing you in there.
No problem. I think about it a lot, but I feel like what's hindering us the most here is that it's difficult for us to find even anything to read about that is like recent, not outdated, because a lot of dinosaur books that make it here tend to be really commercial, and as you know, that the really commercial ballet art books are not the most rigorous ones, I would say. I'm not trying to be overly critical, because I feel like they're trying their best, but it feels like some people just, it's impossible for everyone to know everything. So yeah, it's just, there's always a reason why people, this is also why I don't want to comment on the bad art question, because I feel like a lot of people just don't have enough information to do things that they could have done. So that's basically what's happening here. And that's also why I don't feel comfortable enough about reconstructing the paleoecology of animals in Southeast Asia, because they're generally understudied. Mm. And a lot of, every time I look at fossils that are found here, they are usually housed somewhere else on the planet. And I don't think I would ever see the fossils ever, because it's not just the distance, but for people in this region, it is really hard for us to travel because of the visa requirements. We need to prove a lot of things, do a lot of paperwork for a chance to be granted the opportunity to apply. And it's just for a chance. So it's never quarantined. So it's really hard for us to actually collaborate with people overseas. But the good thing is that the internet is basically enabling us to do this kind of communication. So I'm really grateful for the crap people who basically have pinched me.
Oh no.
You made it so far.
Yeah, you had to claw that pun in, didn't you?
Yeah. I'm also not an academic person, so I don't have access to journals or whatever. So usually those people would just sent me copies of their paper and all that, and it's really, really helpful.
Yeah, I know it's a huge topic to talk about, but I think it's important for people to realize, if you're listening to this, that there's such an imbalance of where knowledge is located around the world. And through some of my work, I've seen this, but to hear you say that is so poignant, and so, like, that you as an artist in your home country can't see the fossils from your home country because they're reposited in some colonial superpower across the world. And that's utterly crazy and outrageous. And that's how our discipline is kind of built. But crabs, eh?
Actually, I only saw my first ever dinosaur fossil mound when I was 25.
Wow.
Because I think there's only one museum here that has fossils. I know that they have some kind of pterosaur. I'm not sure if it's a T-Rex or a different species. They have one museum here and just one throughout for the entire country. And it's not even a paleo museum, it's a geological museum.
Wow. Right. On the other hand, couldn't tell you the first time I saw a dinosaur. Yeah. Took it for granted.
Yeah, just completely take it for granted, don't you? You can even walk into sort of very small local museums and probably will see dinosaur remains. It's just wild.
Yeah.
Or like any university in the UK will have some kind of dinosaur collection.
Yeah, my university where I did my PhD had a juvenile T-Rex skeleton, for God's sake, like in the hallway. It's crazy. Oh.
It's also related to the geology of the region, though, because as I say, this area is really wet and humid, so most things are not really well preserved here.
Mm.
I feel like the only Mesozoic vertebrate, maybe not vertebrate, or maybe amniote or reptile, maybe the only one that I'm aware of that have ever been found in this area is an ichthyosaur, and I think it's just the lower jaw, and that's it, basically. It's just, we are just not really a good place for things to die.
if
you want to get the flies, just don't die here.
Yeah. This kind of segues into a question that I wanted to ask you, which is that another thing that you've talked about a lot on Twitter is going out into the wild, and like you said, you're really into bugs and identifying bugs and trying to, what's the right word? Showcase,
catalog, I guess.
Showcase like your local wildlife. Yeah, and you go out and is it iNaturalist that you use that where you catalog it? So tell us about that. Like, how did you get involved with that? Like, what happened, and how many bugs have you identified now?
So iNaturalist is a public platform. It's a website/app that everyone basically can use for free. And it's basically, well, we are all basically 90s kids, right? So we know how Pokemon works. So iNaturalist is a little bit more like that. It's an app/website where you can photograph animals or plants in the wild and then upload it to the server. And then people all over the world are gonna try to identify what is it, the thing that you're seeing in your backyard or whatever. And I think it's a really powerful tool that people here can use to connect with experts overseas to actually identify what is actually happening in my backyard, in my area, in my city, because a lot of animals here are basically understudied. Every time I was talking to some British folks a while ago, and they were just talking to me about their moths and spiders, and we have this many hundred moths in my country, and I was like, I don't even know how many mods we have here because we don't even know their names. Nobody has ever worked on them. They're basically understudied, and obviously being in the tropics, we just have more species than you do there. We don't have enough funds, enough people to do all the dirty work, to collect them, to sort them, and to identify them. So iNaturalist has been really useful for me personally to show people not just the kind of diversity that people can appreciate, but also to show expert overseas. There are probably these kind of things that you might be interested in seeing. Maybe you would like to work with someone local over here whom you can probably write a paper together with. Because even in my backyard, I've identified maybe 10 or more unidentified species that are probably new to science in my own backyard.
Wow. That's crazy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Just, that's cool.
Yeah, that's really, really cool.
Yeah. Your passion for doing this as well is, it's crazy. I don't think you'd find, or nowadays you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody with such passion for collecting and documenting this kind of stuff, particularly in an area where it's so understudied and the resources are so limited. And I think that's really like motivating and inspiring to do more of our own in our own little patch, no matter where that might be.
Yeah, this is why I'm inviting everyone to do invertebrates, because they're so understudied. So everything you do is going to matter a lot.
Big impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With you said iNaturalist was a bit like Pokemon. Do you get a rival who you have to fight every so often with your...
Yeah. So their website has a leaderboard system where you can specify maybe a country or maybe a specific group of animals. So you can see maybe who is the person who has photographed most butterflies in Indonesia or in the UK. So you can compare how, maybe not really score, but how many uploads you have made there compared to other people. And for a while, I was the top 5 user for Indonesia were all foreigners. That was the situation for maybe a couple of years or so. But then I started to have more time because I used to live in a big city, but then I moved back with my mom in a small town, and it's so much easier to find things here. So I wanted to aim to be the number one in the country in terms of uploads. I held the title for maybe a week or so.
Hey.
Because in January last year, just before COVID happened, I was invited to talk to the iNaturalist crew in Singapore for just a casual hangout. And just the weekend before the meeting with the crew, my friend / rival actually beat me to it, and he became number one, and it's just impossible for me to catch up ever since. I've 9,000 in total, 9,000 things, including plants and all that, and he was just barely above me around then, and he's now at 20,000. It's just impossible to
beat. Oh my goodness.
20,000.
I was gonna like maybe copyright dependent, I'll put the Pokemon theme tune in the background, but I think maybe like, maybe not.
Yeah, not a good idea. He is an actual biology student and I'm not, so it's
rigged. It's all rigged.
Sorry. That's fine. I'm still number two. That's fine.
That's phenomenal. I can't believe that the top leaderboard was people who aren't from the country. And
I feel like it's a big thing with apps like this. I talk about it with the iNet crew, is that a lot of people here don't really have unlimited mobile data. And also sometimes their phone cameras are probably not really good for things like small bugs and all that, because bugs are everywhere, but also at the same time, they're not really accessible because you often need special equipment to photograph them.
Macro lenses and things.
So that's why I feel like there's a disparity between the foreigners who come here, who are usually tourists who come here especially because they know they can find wildlife here. of the locals. Yeah, so those are basically the people who came here and found what they're looking for.
Right. And gamed the system. But
you knocked them off the top spot.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Well, I was number one for a bit, that's fine.
You can still you wear that crown. It's all good.
Yeah, that should definitely be like the other than being like king of all crab memes, like the second thing should just be like number one on your CV. That's it.
Yeah, it's like that. It reminds me very much of like when I'm on Duolingo, this random person whose name is like RBC123 or something like that. I'm gonna beat you this week. It's gonna happen. And then they're in the next league, and you're like, damn it.
Oh dear.
Finding other rivalries on the internet is like the strangest thing, but it also is really entertaining.
Yeah, it is. If you can just keep it to the non-toxic level, though.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because you don't.
It's the crucial thing.
You don't want to be like, you know, like you get so keen that in a newspaper, like in 2 weeks' time, it's like someone had their legs broken by someone else who due to an iNaturalist rivalry.
By bugs.
Yeah. Well, I think that we're getting towards the end of our hourly slot. So I think that's probably quite a good place to wrap up there.
Internet feuds and bugs.
Yeah, internet feuds and breaking people's legs because they captured too many woodlice.
Only the best content over here.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I guess we'll leave it there. And I'll say thanks very much to everyone for joining us tonight. And we will not be back next week. We're going to take a week break. And then we're going to be back the week after that. And remember that you can listen to us anywhere where you can download your podcasts. We'll be updating our website, so we'll have lots of news about our upcoming guests. Don't forget that you can follow us on Twitter. And with that, I just want to say thanks very much to our guest Franz. You've taught us quite a lot. Our first paleo artist. And it's been really, really great to talk to you today. So thank you very much for coming on. You can follow Franz on Twitter. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Oh, sorry. I was looking at my notes and you said something and it scared me. I was like, ah! Yeah, you can follow Franz on Twitter at FranzAnt. And we hope that you'll join us next time for our next paleo party. So goodbye, everyone. Thanks very much.
Bye.
See you later.
Bye, Crab Army.
Bye, Crab Army. Oh, no. The crab people are going to come after us.